This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector. Investigative conversations about issues that impact our lives. Be curious. Friday mornings at 9 a.m. only on 101.9 Chai FM.
This is The Deep Dive, and I'm your host as usual, Brooke Spector. And today I'm really delighted to have I'm always delighted with my guests. We pick guests who are interesting, but I'm delighted today with our guest, Patina Gappa, a novelist. And she was recently in Johannesburg for the Johannesburg Festival of Women Writers. And I unfortunately was not able to attend, but I am really pleased to have this one-on-one conversation with her. She's a Zimbabwean, although she was born, if I read her biography appropriately, she was actually born just across the border in Zambia. She went back to Zimbabwe as a child, did university studies there, and then went off to Cambridge and Austria, if I have that correct. And she's got lots of degrees. There probably isn't enough wall space in her apartment for this. She's got all these certificates, I'm sure. And what fascinates me further is that she worked as an international economics lawyer for the World Trade Organization. That is not your normal career choice as a writer. It's fascinating to me. I'm going to ask her later on, I want her to think about this. Is she a writer who happens to be a lawyer, or is she a lawyer who's decided that she really has to scratch the itch of being a writer? Now, I came across her name a few years ago. Another broadcaster, an old and dear friend, Jenny Cruz Williams, had read her book, and I believe you know her too, or have been interviewed by her. She read one of your novels, Rotten Road, and she buttonholed me and said, "You must read this book or else." Yes, Jenny. Yes, I'll read the book. So I went out, got the copy of the book, and was absolutely enthralled by the book. I was enthralled by the way it was put together, by its structure, its characters, and the fact that it created a kind of universe, the way, let's throw some names around. Dickens created a universe of people, and Balzac created a universe of people, and Edith Wharton created a universe of people. But what was interesting, fascinating about it was that it was a series of short stories, and some of the characters reappeared in each other's short stories, and they all sort of wove together like a giant tapestry. We're delighted to have a chance to talk with you with that long introduction, and thank you for joining us.
Oh, Brooks, thank you so, so much. I mean, I'm delighted to join you, and I'm even more delighted now that I know you're such good mates with my dear friend Jenny, who is the person who made me big in South Africa. I have to give her all the props, because when my first book came out in 2009, she interviewed me, I think it was 3 times in 1 week, and she got so much interest, not only from South African readers, she also managed to reach a very significant section of my audience, which is Zimbabweans living in South Africa. So I'm very happy to be here talking to you. And of course, I'm familiar with your work, and it's a pleasure to be here.
Well, Jenny's one of my neighbors, actually, and we see her every once in a while, literally just a couple of streets away. We talk, and sometimes we even share meals. And she said, "You have to read the book." And I did. And I spent the whole weekend just reading it, because it really was quite something.
I was going to say, the next time you see Jenny, please tell her that I finally finished the Jane Austen in Zimbabwe book. And we can talk about that a little bit later.
Okay, we will. We will do just that. Do you see yourself as a writer who just happens to have a career occasionally as a lawyer, international trade lawyer? Or are you a trade lawyer who wakes up late at night and writes? Where are you situated in that world?
I think I'm part of a very interesting tradition, right, of writers who also have other jobs. Think of Toni Morrison. She only wrote her first novel after the age of 40, after having spent her life as an editor. You know, she was a books editor, and then she became a writer. Think of one of my favorite writers, P.D. James, the English crime novelist. best. You know, she spent, you know, again, her first 40 years as an administrator in the National Health Service. And then she became a writer. Think of, I think it was Kafka, who was an insurance clerk. Think of T.S. Eliot, who was, a publisher and a books editor. So there are quite a number of writers who have other jobs and then come to writing late. And I belong to that particular group. And it's not because I didn't want to be a writer. I primarily wanted to be a lawyer. It's quite the opposite. I always wanted to be a writer. But then I was born at a time when my country was called Rhodesia. I was actually born outside the country, as you very correctly said. And growing up, there weren't any Black female Zimbabwean authors who wrote in English. There really weren't any until 1988, when Tsitsi Dangarembwa wrote Nervous Conditions, and she became the first Black female author to write in English. And I only read that book when I was already in third year at university. So I didn't have before me an example of the kind of writer that I could be. So because I like to argue, I like to talk a lot, my teachers and my father recommended that I should study law. So I became a lawyer who then became a writer. So that's a sort of a long winded way of saying that I see myself as both a writer and a lawyer.
Well, I mean, you were giving me this list of names of interesting writers who crossed the threshold from one career to the other. In my notes, I wrote down Joseph Conrad,
yes,
who for years was a merchant seaman and a captain of merchant vessels. And I guess one day woke up and realized that the thing he wanted to do in life was to write novels in English and become a proper English gentleman rather than sailing around the Pacific.
Absolutely. And what that does, if you have another sort of profession or another background to your writing, is that somehow that background can occasionally seep into your writing. I mean, think of Joseph Conrad, as you say, The Heart of Darkness, right? It's essentially a novel about the Congo, about the river, right? And the river sort of like weaves its way into the narrative, The Secret Sharer, that wonderful short story of his. And I think that my background as a lawyer does really affect how I write. I see the world in terms of justice versus injustice. And you talked about Rotten Row, which I'm so delighted that you liked it because it's my favorite book that I've written. And you can really see the influence of my legal background in those stories about justice and crime and punishment.
You sort of just preempted my next question, which was, does the idea or the ideal of justice, it seems to permeate what you're writing? Is this just accidental, or do you deliberately seek out the way to do that?
I don't think it's accidental. I mean, the question of what is justice is something that obviously is very close to me as a result of my legal background, but also I'm fascinated by, you know, just the very notion of what justice is and how justice can be delayed, how justice can come after several years. And that's why I love the concepts from my culture of restorative justice, right? Mm. I'm really obsessed with this idea of Ngozi. I don't know whether you read my first novel called The Book of Memory, which is partly about that, how justice can be delayed for hundreds and hundreds of years. So it's something that is the question of preoccupation that comes to me not only from my career as a lawyer, but also from my condition as a woman of the Shona people who are interested in these questions of how justice can be recalibrated, how justice can be restored, especially in view of terrible crimes like murder. You know, terrible crimes like murder. We didn't have capital punishment until we were colonized, right? And by the way, that's another of my battles, you know, the fight against capital punishment. And one of the things that I'm really happy about is that our government recently abolished capital punishment, because I think as a form of justice, it's more of a form of revenge.
I'm so glad you mentioned the question of capital punishment, because a couple of years ago, I was asked to write a review of a non-novel. Scott Turow, of course, is a writer of fiction who was a practicing attorney for many years. And he wrote a book explaining how he had come from a support of capital punishment to his opposition to it after years of legal practice and realizations that sometimes the wrong people get killed by the state because they mishandled the criminal justice system in the first place. And because you can't do much about it once someone has been killed by the state. They're dead, they're dead. He came to the conclusion that he'd been wrong about it all along, and he had to switch over and oppose it.
I remember reviews of that book, and I think yours might even have been one of them. Was it in the Mail and Guardian that you published it? I can't remember the name of the book. What was it called again? The Burden of Proof. What was it called?
No, I'm going to draw a blank, but when I write this down, I will have found
you gotta
right
fill in the gap. That's right.
No, my review actually ended up in the South African Journal of International Relations.
Oh, fantastic. Oh, fantastic. I remember that very well. And I remember thinking that it was a real step of courage for a man, you know, Scott, who had been working in the American justice system, to come out and say, I've been wrong about this all the time. And, you know, the U.S., I think, along with Japan, are the last two industrialized nations to maintain the death penalty. South Africa, you abolished it ages ago. And it's partly because South Africa abolished the death penalty that I believe Zimbabwe ended up abolishing it too, and for one very practical reason. So we abolished the death penalty last year in 2025, but we hadn't had an execution since 2013. And you know why? Because, and this is a bit of macabre humor for you, Brooks, to be a hangman, because we used hanging as the method of execution, to be a hangman, you had to have experience as a hangman. You can't just rock up from, you know, your rural area in wherever and say, I want to be a hangman. You have to be experienced, because it's a very brutal way to kill somebody. So we used to get our hangmen from South Africa, right? Especially from South Africa. But because South Africa abolished the death penalty, there were no experienced hangmen to do the job, you know? So thank you, South Africa, for paving the way for us to abolish the death penalty.
That is very, very interesting. We're going to take a quick break. This is The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and my guest today, Patina Kapa, novelist and international lawyer. And we wandered away from some of our original topics, but I'm really glad we got to the places we did. We'll be right back after these messages.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive, and I am your host, Brooke Spector, and my guest today, novelist, lawyer, Patina Kapa. We were talking about one of her novels that I came to really appreciate, Rotten Row, and then we wandered into the rather more contested territory of capital punishment, which is, I hadn't expected that. That wasn't in my notes, but I'm really glad we got there. You've answered, in a sense, the question that I was going to get to, which is the way in which you conceive of the use of literature in pursuit of justice.
You know what? That's a really interesting question, but it's a very lofty one, because it assumes certain things about my writing. And I would prefer that judgment be left to others. You know, it's like what happened in 2010, I think it was, when the paperback of my first edition came out, and my publishers had put this very lofty language about how Patina Kapa has contributed to the canon of Zimbabwean literature. And I asked them to take that off, because it's not for me to say that I've contributed to the canon, right? It's for other people. It's a judgment of time. So I'm very reluctant to talk about whether my writing contributes to justice or not, but I can certainly say that I hope it does, you know, raise questions around notions of justice and what justice looks like and what justice means.
Fair enough. I mean, whenever I see someone with a sort of a self-justifying quote on the back of their book, or even on the front cover, describing that writer or that work as, you know, preeminent among all such works, or the writer is a genius, or whatever it is, you wonder just exactly how that ended up, who got selected and how they did it and why they did it, and did they get a promotional fee for it as well? You were here for a conference about women writers or women in writing. I'm not sure there's a distinct difference. What is your feeling about whether or not we're talking about women writers or writers who happen to be female? Is there a difference in that texture?
Let me answer that by saying that I was really thrilled to be invited to be the keynote speaker at the Johannesburg Festival of Women Writers. And it's a festival that was started by a very well-known South African ambassador, Barbara Masakela. She was South Africa's first ambassador to, I think it was France and UNESCO. And then subsequently, she was ambassador to the United States. And before that, I think she had been President Nelson Mandela's chief of staff. And before that, she comes from this very well-known family, the Masakela family, including the musician Hugh Masakela, who's her brother, who was anti-apartheid activist. So it was a pleasure to meet somebody that I'd read about for many years, and a pleasure to help her grow her festival, which is dedicated to women writers and to writing by women. And I think it's a very timely contribution to have a festival that is dedicated to women writers, because, I mean, you follow African literature. I'm sure it hasn't been lost on you that a lot of the women who are writing from the continent, a lot of the prominent women, female authors are, you know, women writers. But we still talk about Chinua Achebe and Wole Soyinka and Afua Fugard and, you know, Eskia Mpatlele. Not that we shouldn't, but I think we seem to have lost sight of the fact that there's been a shift in who's writing what kind of stories about the continent. So the idea that we could have a festival that is dedicated to, you know, those human beings who hold up half the sky, as the Chinese proverb goes, I think is a really great thing.
No, I must say Barbara's an old friend, and she's actually been on this program as well. You were describing her biography, but you left out one very interesting part. When she was living in the United States, she taught in a university. She taught courses on African diaspora and third world literature to American students.
That I didn't know. Thank you so much for that. I had no idea. She's very modest about what she's done in her life, you know.
Hey, I'm Barbara, you know, and you go, no, there's a little
exactly.
more to
You're
it.
Like, oh, Your Excellency, Ambassador.
We like her lots. I must tell you a story. The first African female writer that I encountered was a novel that came out, oh gosh, back about 1973 or 74 in South Africa by Miriam Plady, Muriel at Metropolitan. A fairly slim novel, I mean, 150 or so pages. It was at a time when pretty much the only other major female writer in Africa who was widely published and read was the late Nadine Gordimer. And what has always intrigued me about writers who are women, who are writing about something beyond a woman's issue, whatever that might be, is the way in which they do or do not convincingly write about men as well.
Oh, this makes me happy. Sorry, I'm going to interrupt you, Brooks. This is exactly one of the points I made on the panel, that what is very interesting about, if you look closer at women's writing, you think that women are going to be writing sort of like the domestic novel, sort of like Jane Austen, the marriage plot kind of novel. But no, I mean, you've got Chimamanda Adichie, who took on the Biafra War. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got Nadine Gordimer, July's People, who took on apartheid, right? You've got so many, and even when the theme is sort of a domestic theme or a family theme, there's usually a very interesting twist on it. I gave an example of my friend Lola Yoshoneyin, who wrote a book called The Secret Wives of Babasegi's Wives, which is a comedy drama about polygamy in Nigeria. Right. So I don't really think that it's true to say anymore that there is one particular theme or thread that is woven or that is followed by women writers. I think it's really interesting when women take on subjects that you don't traditionally associate with women writers. I mean, I recently wrote a novel, which is a very male-centered novel about the African companions of the explorer David Livingstone. It's crowded with men. You know, because there were 73 of them who were carrying the body of this dead Scottish explorer to the coast. So it's wonderful to see that there is as much variety in women's writing as there is in men's writing.
Full disclosure, I happen to be male. So when I read a novel by a male author, I somehow assume that the male author has managed to characterize male characters effectively. Or not. I don't worry about whether they understood their gender. When I read a novel by a woman, at least running in the back of my mind in sort of an unconscious way, is this author accurately and reasonably portraying the other sex?
You can also say the same when men write women. You know, sure. I mean, it's a reason why so many of the bad sex award winners tend to be men.
Right? I didn't know there was an award, but is there really?
A bad sex writing award. I'll send you a link, but I'm going to tell you a funny story. I'm not going to identify the author. There's a young male author who wrote a character in one of his novels. And of course, this character was meant to be very alluring, very sexy, right? And she's a young woman who likes to cook naked in the kitchen, right? Dangerous. The unfortunate thing is, like, one of the dishes that she likes to cook naked was a dish that required a lot of oil. So it splattered, right? And so he talked about how, you know, her breasts swayed from side to side as she was cooking naked. And I'm thinking, she's going to get a lot of hot oil on her skin. So there's an example of a man writing a female character without understanding that the situation he put her into is not at all romantic, but is actually very, very dangerous. No one cooks naked.
There is a TV program, The Naked Chef, but I think he wears clothes.
He also has an apron. All right.
Yes.
This particular young lady didn't even have an apron on. She was just brilliant, you know.
Oh, we have to take another station break. This is High FM's The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and my guest today, really pleased to have this conversation, Zimbabwean author Patina Gapa. And we're talking about a lot of things that aren't in my notes right now. We'll be right back after these messages.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive, and I'm your host, Brooke Spector. My guest today, Patina Gapa, novelist, international lawyer, theoretician of whether or not women can write about men and men can write about women. And just before we took our break, we were discussing a novel by Mr. Anonymous, because we're not going to reveal who it was, who apparently was a winner in the Bad Sex Novel of the Year competition for descriptions of women cooking without clothing, which seems to me to be dangerous as well as complicated. I don't know about this, but this brings to mind the question to me about who reads short stories and novels anymore. And I'm sure this is a topic of interest and concern for writers who like to see people reading their works. We live in a world where TikTok and Instagram and YouTube and other social messaging has sort of taken over. What is your feeling about this concern that people, young people, simply do not read anymore or are no longer interested in reading or have other means to access stories? I mean, it's usually said something like the first time the first story was created around a campfire and some child says to an elder, "Tell me a story." And that's where novels and short stories and plays begin. Are they ending? Are we giving up on this concept?
First of all, I love that you talk about the first story, right? Because somebody who said, "Tell me a story," wasn't saying, "Write me a story," or "Write me a novel," or "Write me a short story." It's just, "Tell me a story." So I think the storytelling impulse will always be with us, right? It's just been transferred elsewhere, right? For a long time, books and were the medium by which people sort of like conveyed stories, right? But now it's not only film and television, but it's also TikTok and so on. But I want to talk about Wuthering Heights because it's a very interesting example of what can happen. After the very bizarre, in terms of costumes, plot and everything, a version of Wuthering Heights starring, I think it was Margot Robbie and I can't remember the male actor, came out huge on TikTok with this generation. And guess what the result was? The result was youngsters flocking to bookshops, to Amazon, to order Wuthering Heights, to read it. right? Of course, they were put off within the first 20 pages because it's a very difficult story. It wasn't as sexy as it is on the film, right? It's meandering, and it's a story within a story within a story, you know. But it gave me a lot of heart, because it shows you that Wuthering Heights in 2026 can become a bestseller amongst the TikTok generation, right? So it's not really a question that books have died or novels have died. It's a question of how do we get books to young people using the mediums that attract them the most.
I think there have been 10, maybe I'm wrong, but I think there have been 10 versions of Wuthering Heights made either for film or for television broadcast. And each of them has sort of picked a very different angle. One is like the current one that's all about thwarted intimate relations. Others are about the moodiness of where this is all taking place. And others are about anger management, I guess. But it's been a long time since I read Wuthering Heights, I must confess. And I've been very reluctant to go see this movie.
I'll give you another example. So George Martin is under fire for not finishing the Game of Thrones series, right? I mean, I'm a huge Game of Thrones fan. I've read the novels. I've watched the TV series many, many times, trying to avoid the last season because it was so terrible. But here's another example of, this is a series, it had its loyal followers, and then it became a big TV sensation, and it reached an even bigger audience. And now those, you know, people who are part of that audience want to go back to the original, right? Because they feel that the TV series got a lot of things wrong. There were many characters that were cut out. So my point really is that stories will always be with us, and whether they are told through books, novels, etc., I don't really think that we can say for certain that books are dying, because for as long as stories are living and are a part of how we explain ourselves, then I think there will always be room for rediscovery of books, of reading, and the joys of literature.
This is The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and my guest today, I'm really pleased to have a chance to meet her, even if it's just virtually, Bettina Gapa, the author, Zimbabwean. We've been talking about just a whole wide range of. She was finishing up her explanation of the way in which people went back to books for Game of Thrones because they were less than pleased with the way in which television was portraying the story, leaving out characters, twisting the plot lines, and it wasn't satisfying enough to people. So they went back to actually read the books. Is that going to be a familiar concept for us with serialization of things? Should we expect this to happen?
I think so. I think Game of Thrones certainly created an appetite for a particular kind of story, right? And then if it's not satisfying enough, you try to go back to the source material. And then if that is not satisfying, you know what people do? They write fan fiction. They write their own version. They write their own version. So I think there's something quite amazing about the way that people engage, especially with the more formula forms of entertainment. And in terms of reading, it's sort of certainly looking here at the continent, I'm actually quite optimistic about, certainly in my country, and what I saw in South Africa at the weekend, you know, people turning up to festivals to buy books, perhaps not in as large numbers as we would like, but almost every writer that I know who's been to a festival talks about how people come and they buy books and they try to have, you know, the book signed. And there was a friend of mine who went to a festival in Soweto. It was called Abantu, I think. Unfortunately, it's no longer running, but they were talking about people buying books by the bucketful in Abantu, and I've certainly experienced this at literary festivals the world over. I've been to about 70 festivals with my four books across the world, right? But perhaps you could argue that, well, maybe literary festivals attract book lovers anyway, so maybe that's not who we should be looking at. But I really want to believe that there is still a lot of hope and optimism for literature, for books, for novels, for short stories.
We talked about TV or film serialization and the way in which the novel Wuthering Heights has been adapted and misadapted over the years. But what that, at least in terms of a book like Rotten Row, it seemed to me to be absolutely ripe for the idea of television or serialization for television because it's so episodic. Has anybody come to you and said, hey, here's a contract, let's turn this one into a TV series?
Well, I've said that to myself. I've turned three of the stories into a play. I'm also a playwright. I write for the theater here in Zimbabwe. But you've just given me a brilliant idea. I think it should be possible to have maybe 10 stories from Rotten Row adapted for like 20-minute or 30-minute sort of a series. I think that could probably work. The problem, of course, is that those are not the kind of stories that will attract like a Hollywood sort of producer. And at the same time, here in Harare, we don't really have money to make, you know, like world-class films. So we'd have to get very creative about how we adapt those stories. Let me think on that. And Brooks, if it happens, you're coming on as an executive producer because you gave me the idea.
100%. I'm ready for this. I mean, I mentioned that because in a whole series of novels that are based in Botswana, what is it? First Lady's Detective Agency.
Agency, yes.
And some of them have become films rather than television. And they're not about, I mean, there isn't death and destruction everywhere and cars don't explode. And, you know, there aren't terrible things happening to people. They're sort of like the detective story version of domestic life in a way.
Yes.
Which I get the sense that much of your own writing has that flavor to it. It's domestic writing, but in a very special kind of way. But I will happily be an executive producer for this work. I'm ready when you are. I'm actually listed in one film made in Japan that way because I helped sort out the director and producer's visa issues when we were living in Japan. As a gift to me, I'm list. If you can stop the video for, you know, for like 1 second as it flashes past, my name is in there. I got no payment, but it was one of those lovely thrills. Hey, I've been an executive producer of a film.
Could you read the Japanese, or did they render your name in English?
Oh no, it was in both actually.
Okay, that by the way is for me the most thrilling aspects of being a published writer, being published in all these incredible languages. So I'm published in Japanese, right? And just the idea of being read from left to right and also in Arabic, it's like, wow, it's incredible. It's just incredible. And that's the other part of my answer to your question about are books dying? I mean, if you see what's happening in other languages, mm-hmm. Right? What's happening in Spanish, what's happening in Portuguese, what's happening in Arabic and so on. You'll actually see that in some instances, there's an expansion of what's available to read because of the power of translation rather than a shrinking of it. So I'm an optimist.
No, I hope you're right. I mean, you can't go on a train or a bus or a subway in Tokyo and not see people reading, although a fair number of them are reading graphic novels these days rather than
manga, yes.
Yeah, novels that are with, you know, lots of words. We don't have a whole lot of time left. We're going to take one last ad break, and then I want to come back with one more question about your literary mentors, the people, the authors that influenced you. This is The Deep Dive, and I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and my guest today on IFM, Patina Gappa, Zimbabwean author, and now we discover aspiring television producer. What else? We'll be right back after these messages.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector, as usual. And today, my guest, Patina Gappa, Zimbabwean novelist. We have been talking about all manner of things, but what we haven't done is, in the time remaining, just a couple of minutes, is ask her who were the authors that gave her the feeling that there was some place for her to write, something to say. Who were the literary mentors? Maybe not the actual person who said, go write, my dear, go write. But when you read them, you said, that's what I want to do. Who were these authors?
Gosh, there are quite a few, because I write in three genres, right? I write novels, I write short stories, and I write plays. So I started out as a short story writer. So my mentors, if I can call them that, tend to be other short story writers. I learned a lot from people like Mavis Galland, who wrote this incredible series called The Paris Stories. I learned a lot from Edward P. Jones, who was an African-American short story writer and is a specialist short story writer. I read The Dubliners, James Joyce, exactly, that famous short story collection of his. Frank O'Connor, another short story writer. So I read and I read widely, and I read beyond my continent. You know, I don't just stick to writers from Africa, even though I've been, of course, influenced by people like Sisi Ngarembwa, who was the first Black woman from my country to write a novel. I've been influenced by Wole Soyinka in terms of my playwriting. But I look for my influences, and I find my influences in many, many places. George Orwell is a particular influence of mine, to the point where I've translated Animal Farm into Shona, right? It's called Chimurenga Chemuka, The Animal Revolution. And what I love about Orwell is that incredible statement where he said, I've always tried to make political writing into an art. So one of the biggest honors of my life came when I was shortlisted for the Orwell Prize in 2010. That was just something incredible. And in terms of plays, goodness, I've got so many influences from, as I mentioned, Wole Soyinka, and then there is the guy who wrote Amadeus, Peter Schaeffer, of course, Peter Schaeffer.
Sorry, I just drew a blank as well. Unfortunately, we're going to have to call time on this because we have really run out of time, and it's not fair.
Oh, that was a great conversation.
But we will have to get back to you at some point after your television series begins.
can I just add one small sentence which you may want to include?
Please.
Which my current novel is inspired by my favorite Jane Austen novel, which is Persuasion, the last novel. So I've taken Jane Austen and brought her to Zimbabwe, and I hope that people will like the result.
I look forward to that. That will be something else. Okay, we will see how that goes. Jane Austen.
Great. Thank you so much.
Hey, this
thank
has been
so
a great pleasure.
Yeah, thank you for the organizing.
This was a thrill for me. We've been speaking with Patina Gapa, a Zimbabwean novelist and thinker of the universality of literature, and the list of people who influenced her is quite something. I was real pleased to hear that too. This is The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector. We'll be back again next week. In the meantime, you all be safe, be careful, and have a good weekend.